It was the first multinational corporation, aggressive, rapacious, able to draw on a private army to achieve its goals. The East India Company, or the EIC, was the unlikely entity which crushed India's mighty Mughal Empire in the 18th century and went on to dominate world trade. But how did they do it? How did a company set up to source spices and chintz for an impoverished Britain, conquer southern Asia, and then proceed to rule it from a boardroom in London? For the historian and author William Dalrymple, the conquest of India was, at heart, a ruthless corporate takeover, which contains useful lessons for our own age. It's the subject of his new and highly entertaining book, The Anarchy, and he joins me from London. William Dalrymple, a pleasure to have you there.
Very nice to hear you again, Geraldine.
Who thought up the company and for what purpose?
So, what's important about the opening of the East India Company was it was one of the world's very first joint stock companies. Today, we're used to the idea of a corporation where people can invest money and get a share of the profits. But this was the way most businesses were run through most of history. It was a Tudor invention. The first one was something called the Muscovy Company, which was founded in the 1550s to trade with Moscow. And the East India Company was probably the world's fourth joint stock company, which meant that it wasn't, you know, just a bunch of merchants trading with family members like the Marco Polo family trading with China or the Medici Bank lending money, you know, from family capital. Nor was it a guild where, you know, a bunch of wool merchants might put their capital together and trade with the Low Countries or something. The idea was that anyone could invest. And in the first meeting of the East India Company, which was held in London, not only did the Lord Mayor and all the usual ship owners and pirates and privateers and the rich merchants turn up, but you have these wonderful lists of people who are vintners and skinners and grocers and haberdashers. In other words, you know, the small London businessmen that had £10 or £20 to spare, and they put their money in too. And this was the crucial thing, because this vehicle, the joint stock company, was a way of realizing vast sums of capital, potentially, which any other business model could never manage. And in due course, the East India Company grew to be the model for, you know, today's mega corporations like Facebook or ExxonMobil or Walmart, these vast corporations that if they were countries,
but
in the case of ExxonMobil, if it was a country, would be the 14th richest country in the world above Norway.
But how did they arrive at the idea of trade with India? I mean, that was a bold gamble, was it not?
Well, originally it wasn't India per se, it was the Indies, which meant what we would call Indonesia. And Indonesia, particularly the island of Run, was the center of the world's cloves, cinnamon, and particularly nutmeg. And the company initially was in a sort of two-horse race with the Dutch. And the Dutch were actually better sailors. They had more ingenious financial instruments and were able to raise greater sums of capital. And the early history of the company is of losing to the Dutch. And eventually there's this famous swap when the British hand over to the Dutch the island of Run. And in return, they're given a muddy, barren island in the middle of the Hudson River called Manhattan, which at the time seemed like a very bad deal. But anyway, the company then reverts to its second best option, which is trading in textiles, in silks, chintzes, woven cotton, some of these wonderful Mughal textures called buff hawa, woven air. And these are all products of India. So the company engages with India, which is then at the peak of its wealth. It controls, the Mughal Empire controls about 37% of world GDP. It's just overtaken China in the early 1700s. And it's the East India Company is the force that ships this incredible wealth of textiles around the world. And so although the East India Company loses its first choice, by default, it ends up attached to the biggest industrial powerhouse of the day.
Well, indeed, there are some fabulous descriptions in this book. You describe the contrast in early encounters between the Mughals ruling India and early English traders. And the Mughals had the upper hand in every sense. What was in it for them to trade with the English?
Well, the Indians wanted nothing from the English other than bullion. And this had been the case with Western traders trading with India since the time of the Romans. Pliny the Elder, writing in Imperial Rome around the time of Christ, complains that rich, luxurious Roman ladies are begging for diamonds, sandalwood paste, and silks, all of which were products of India. He complains about this drain of Roman wealth from Rome over the seas to India in return for these luxuries. And this was the same in the 18th century when the British first went there. You know, there was nothing India wanted from the West. They didn't want English broadcloth or tapestries or all the sort of things that English were good at making. And so the British had to just ship gold and silver overseas.
Yes, I suppose that it's the crudity, I suppose. I mean, exactly what you've described there. I mean, the Mughals had these, they want to talk poetry, you've sort of said. The rather uncouth English want to talk trade. The Mughals had massive armies. They were very elaborate and sophisticated. And the English realised they couldn't just bulldoze their way in, could they? They had to create a partnership and they had to learn how to flatter and bribe and play by the rules of the rulers.
Exactly. I mean, you know, learning languages has never been a particular English talent.
No.
And I just have to say. But the East India Company did begin to learn the refinements of Mughal manners. It learned how to bribe the Mughal court. It learned how to speak perfect Persian and Hindustani. And you do find the company beating all its rivals, the French, the Dutch, and so on, and gradually establishing themselves as the principal Western trader with India. So 1640 to about 1700, during that time, India is producing not only the Taj Mahal and Mughal miniatures, but, you know, textiles to match. The incredible refinement of everything made in India at that period makes these products, you know, incredibly sellable across the world.
And the
company is the force that exports Mughal goods around not just Europe, but even to the New World.
And you do talk about the death of Aurangzeb, the extraordinary tyrant, ruler, clever man, Aurangzeb. All was around this time of a pivot point, wasn't it? And the English did, their fighting power increased immensely, and they just started to make huge amounts of money, and they want to protect this. So all of this was a sort of a perfect storm, wasn't it?
Exactly. The Mughal Empire, which has 4 million men under arms, and which, you know, there's one British attempt to force themselves on in the 17th century on the Mughal Empire, and they're just swatted aside like flies. But after the fall of the Mughals in the 18th century, this is like a beautiful mirror has been thrown out of a second story window, and it shatters into 1,000 glittering fragments on the ground. And it's the East India Company that is in a position at that point to start hoovering up one by one these different fragments. So while India remains united and strong, the company can't even get a foothold. But once the Mughal Empire is broken up and you get all these little states, the Carnatic, the Avad, Bengal, the Marathas, the Sikhs and the Punjab and so on. These are all, you know, incredibly cultured, incredibly vibrant, but they're small states with small militaries. And Britain has just come out of the War of the Austrian and Spanish succession. And Frederick the Great has revolutionized warfare in Europe. He's invented the socket bayonet, the elevating screw on the back of artillery, little things that transform warfare in the 18th century. And by importing these new forms of warfare to this newly fractured India, the company suddenly realized it has the power, as a trading company, suddenly has the power to take on vast Indian armies and defeat them. And that's exactly what happens in the 18th century.
You do say that in this 18th century, the EIC essentially staged a corporate takeover of a whole country. And this is where you really depart, William, from the accepted historical narrative of Britain's conquest of India. So make your case, please.
Well, I don't think anything that I say would be at all surprising to anyone in the 18th century. It was well known in the 18th century that it was this one London business controlled from one London office block, the East India Company headquarters in Leadenhall Street, just literally around the corner from where I'm speaking to you now, that controlled India. And there's a great deal of indignation in the British press when the reports start emerging that this company is enslaving Indians, is conquering great areas of the country, is locking the weavers into sort of, you know, weaving camps that are sort of precursors to concentration camps. And there are plays put up in London in the 18th century with with Clive, who's the head of the East India Company, being parodied as Lord Vulture. People like Horace Walpole, the diarist, writes that we have outdone the Spanish in Latin America. They at least had the excuse of religion. We are just there for profit. Mm-hmm. But the Victorians respun the story of the British in India and turned it into a national story of, you know, imperial glory and so on. And in a sense, Indian nationalists bought this line and just inverted it. So for Indian nationalists, it was a story of national liberation and from oppression. The fact that it was actually a corporate story has got lost in the retelling. But, you know, it's unequivocally the case. The East India Company was not operating out of Downing Street. These wars were, by and large, not fought by the British Army and the British Navy. These wars were fought by the East India Company's own army and own navy. And by the 1799, the East India Company army is almost exactly double the size of the British Army. There are 100,000 troops in the British Army just before they rearmed to fight Napoleon and culminating in Waterloo. And at that point, the East India Company employs 200,000 sepoy mercenaries. It's a vast army. It's the largest modern army in the world. And this is owned by a corporation. I mean, it's an extraordinary bit of history.
Yes, and in fact, reading your book, it's astonishing, really, to be reminded how much power the East India Company had. As you write, they were able to reverse the balance of world trade and subjugate a subcontinent and its people, all from an office in London. Has there ever been a comparable corporation?
There hasn't, thank God. I mean, you know, for all that we have these vast corporations today, the Facebook and Google are listening to us as we have this conversation. We'll probably offer you lots of East India Company products tomorrow on your phone. But you know, these are tame beasts compared to the company. For a modern corporation to have the same power, you'd have to, you know, it would be Facebook with nuclear jets. You know, and thankfully, we haven't got to that yet. Just to give you a picture of East India Company power at this point, in about, let's say, 1800, the East India Company has built a third of London's docklands. Its annual spending in Britain alone is about half that of the British government. It's the country's largest employer. It's growing opium in India, which it's selling to China illegally, in the largest narco operation in history. With the profits from that, it's buying tea, which it sells not only in India and in Europe, but also in the New World. And it's East India Company tea that ends up in Boston Harbor during the Boston Tea Party. So this is the world's first big multinational company that really does span the globe and really is shown to be more powerful than nation states. Not only does it attack and conquer nation states in India, it's also caught bribing the British government. I mean, within a century of its founding in 1697, it's found to be offering parliamentarians share options if they vote to extend its monopoly. So, you know, the beginning of this whole world of corporate lobbying, the beginning of this world where corporations can overthrow governments, the East India Company is the root of that story.
Yes, and it does flip, doesn't it, after the what we used to call the Indian Mutiny, and I think is now called, what is it now called, the 1857?
Well, in India, it has been for a long time called the First War of Independence.
Yes, exactly.
And in Britain, it's the Sepoy Mutiny. But I think the best neutral term is probably the Great Uprising.
The Great Uprising. Now, and then, I'm right, am I not, that then it did become, the British government became far more involved with ruling India. And I've got a marvellous quote here. It isn't in your book. I got it elsewhere from Lord Curzon in 1901. As long as we rule India, we are the greatest power in the world. If we lose it, we shall drop straight away to a third-rate power. So there was
little better than Belgium, I think he continues.
Little better than Belgium is the end of it, I see. So, you know, the stakes were just ramped up massively, weren't they? But as you also point out, not without some conscience or some reflection. You've quoted Walpole, and I notice an unnamed Mughal official who decried the effect that mercantile transaction had on their joint cultures. How common was that sentiment at the time?
So one of the surprises for me researching this was really how much outrage there is in Britain at the time. I mean, there's an awful lot of editorial in British newspapers that reads like, you know, a modern Guardian editorial today, decrying mercantile power and asking how on earth it has happened that a body of merchants rules, you know, 50 million people across the world. But what you get, and this is interesting, you know, since the book opens with being a story about this corporate conquest of India, but it eventually becomes a story that's far more familiar to us today, raising a lot of issues that we all face today about the power of the state versus the power of the corporation. Mm. And initially, it looks as if the corporation is winning. It has new weapons, bribery. So the East India Company has an amazing way of getting its way. And you know, if for example, the Navy is persuaded to send ships to India to defend the company and troops go out and conquer bits of Indian territory, which occasionally happens, that territory doesn't end up being, you know, attached to the crown. It just becomes part of the company's dominions. So you have this initial story of the corporation winning over the power of the state, the power of bribery, the power of greed. And only when the corporation screws up because of its greed, in 1770, there is this enormous famine in Bengal caused by the company's asset stripping of the country. And 5 million Bengalis die in this famine, a fifth of the population of Bengal. And the result is that the company goes nearly bankrupt. And it's very much like, you know, the subprime fiasco from 10 years ago when 30 banks across Europe collapse and the government has to bail the company out. And that's the moment that the power of the state over the corporation begins to be asserted. You get a regulating act. You then get government regulators overseeing the corporation. And it moves from being, in a sense, a kind of, you know, a libertarian wet dream of this sort of completely unregulated company to a public-private partnership. And eventually, in 1857, after the company really screws up at the Indian Mutiny, the state nationalizes the company in modern parlance and takes over, and Queen Victoria becomes the Empress of India. But that is only the last 90 years. The first 250 years of the British in India is a corporate story.
No wonder the modern Indian nationalists and public intellectuals have a contempt for all this. They feel, do they not, that they lost their India to this rapaciousness?
Well, I mean, I think in India it's remembered as in Britain as a national takeover. They blame the British, in inverted commas. But it's very interesting to the response this book has garnered in India. It's generated a huge debate. The other thing that they're interested in, incidentally, I mean, they know the story of plunder. This is something which the British don't know, but the Indians are very familiar with. What they don't know, and what I think this book has what's caused the most stir in India with this book, is the fact that the degree of Indian collaboration. Because the company was, you know, run by financiers, and very early on, they enter into very close business relationships with moneylenders in India. And particularly, there's a group of bankers who are the kind of equivalent of the Rothschilds, who are called the Jagat Sets. And the Jagat Sets are these extraordinary rich bankers based in Murshidabad. And it is they who first bribed the company to overthrow the Nawab of Bengal, not realizing what they're unleashing. Mm. It remains the case throughout the next century that the Indian bankers continue to underwrite the company. So there are only ever 2,000 British merchants based in Bengal during the company period. And they end up borrowing money from Indian bankers to pay for Indian troops to conquer other Indians.
Extraordinary.
And so it is a story of as much a story of collaboration. A lot of Indians in this anarchic period after the fall of the Mughal Empire, when it's a sort of dog-eat-dog world of all these different princes attacking each other and establishing their sovereignties in different parts of India, enough Indian bankers see the East India Company as the least worst option to give them the edge. And consistently through the 18th century, the Indian bankers choose to lend to the company, who, however rapacious they are, however much they plunder and loot, understand about lending with interest. They understand about, you know, repaying loans, and they have civil courts where moneylenders can go and address complaints. And at the end of the day, the Indian financial establishment backs the company as the least worst option available in this time of great turmoil and trouble. So, I mean, the one attractive thing about the company is that, you know, it makes no bones like the later Raj did. It doesn't pretend to be about civilization and railways and bringing help to a benighted India or any imperial nonsense of that sort. The company is very clear, like, you know, modern Goldman Sachs is very clear. Its purpose is to make money for its shareholders.
Mm. All right, William, look, it's a terrific achievement. Thank you very much indeed for sparing the time to talk to us.
Always a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you.
Bye-bye. William Dalrymple's new book is The Anarchy, The Relentless Rise of the East India Company. It's published by Bloomsbury in Australia, and he'll be in Australia later this month. The dates for his appearances are on our website, including his appearance at the Australian satellite presentation of the Jaipur Literature Festival, which he founded. So that's in Adelaide from the 1st to the 3rd of November.